try to explain to you our Hall effect measurements on the terbium rhodium to silicon II. The title is a bit more general, Hall effect near a quantum critical point. As an introduction, I will speak a little bit about Fermi surface reconstructions across a quantum critical point. I introduce what is called the large Fermi surface picture. Then I show the different quantum critical point scenarios, which are much discussed at present, and in particular, some predictions for the Hall effect, if it is measured through this quantum critical point. Then I come to the results on the terbium rhodium to silicon II. I first speak on the initial Hall coefficient, that is the Hall coefficient in the vanishingly small magnetic field. And then I show the field tuning experiments, because ytterbium rhodium to silicon II may be tuned through a quantum critical point by the application of a magnetic field. So I will show you how the Hall effect evolves when you tune the system through this field-tuned critical point. I introduce also what we call single and cross-field experiments. And I close with the new phase diagram. And at the end, I would like to show you some experiments from the literature, touching also the same question, how the Fermi surface evolves through quantum critical points in other systems. Let me just acknowledge my co-workers, Thomas Lühmann and Steffen Wirtz, contributed in the Hall effect measurements. The samples came from the Christoph Geibel group and were grown by Octavio Povarelli. Then I acknowledge lots of discussions with colleagues and Professor Steglik at our institute. And theoretical support came from Piers Coleman and Chignol. So, of course, this is very familiar to all of you. It shows the typical phase diagram of a heavy fermion compound which is close to a quantum critical point, which is this point here, which is the point at which an ordering temperature, and usually in heavy fermion compounds this is antiferromagnetism, is continuously suppressed to zero as a function of some tuning parameter, which is usually pressure, doping, or in our case, magnetic field. So you have the ordered state here, and then below a crossover temperature, Landau Fermi liquid behavior is observed. Also in this region, usually Landau Fermi liquid behavior is observed, but in an area on top of this critical tuning parameter, non-Fermi liquid behavior is observed. So deviations from the normal Landau Fermi liquid behavior, such as the linear and T electrical resistivity, or a logarithmically diverging specific heat coefficient. This here is the condo temperature, which somehow shows the temperature scale below which local moments are start to be screened by the conduction electrons. So our question now is, how does the Fermi surface evolve when a system is tuned from the ordered state to the paramagnetic Landau Fermi liquid state? Because we are interested in this because it might help to distinguish between different scenarios. In the spin density wave scenario, which is the standard scenario for heavy fermion quantum critical points, a continuous evolution of the Fermi surface volume is expected if you tune the system through this point. However, there are also alternative scenarios which predict that an abrupt change should be observed. So we will try to answer this, try to look at how the Fermi surface changes through this point to see whether the spin density wave scenario is the correct one or whether new scenarios need to be developed. So this is just a very simple picture for what is called the large Fermi surface picture. So this is the lattice of localized magnetic moments. These are the moments from unfilled shells of the 4F orbitals usually. Like in ytterbium, there's one hole in the 4F shell which gives rise to a local moment. Then we have interaction with the sea of conduction electrons. And then at the lowest temperatures, we have the conduction electrons shield the local moments, and we have a Fermi liquid. And what this theoretical statement says is that if the condo lattice is a Fermi liquid, then the localized spins contribute to the Fermi C volume as electrons. So that means the moments contribute, and we have the ground state has a larger Fermi surface volume. That's a theoretical statement, and of course, let me see. this would apply to this region here in the phase diagram, because there we have a paramagnet, we have a lambda Fermi liquid, and we believe that here, okay, that here the local moments are completely screened, while here they just order. So here there should be a large Fermi surface volume in this state. In fact, there is some experimental indications that this is really true, and these are the Hartzsprung-Alfvén experiments on cerium ruthenium 2 silicon 2. The dots are the experimental data, and the curves are calculations, LDA calculations, where the 4F electron is taken as itinerant, so as contributing to the Fermi surface. And there's overall agreement that the agreement here, which is not so obvious, but there is some agreement. In fact, for example, this beta branch here corresponds to this line. There's just a shift, but the overall agreement is, it's good. At least that's what both experimentalists and theoreticians find, is that this is a support of the large Fermi surface picture, because the 4F electron has to be counted as itinerant in order to get agreement between experimental data and calculated the Hartzsprung-Alfvén branches. So now let me show you the two scenarios. This is the first, the standard scenario, where the ordered phase is believed to be a spin density wave phase. So we have the heavy quasi particles of this paramagnetic phase are not still exist in this phase. And the critical point is just arising due to the fact that these heavy quasi particles are critically scattered from the spin density wave. So they remain, these quasi particles are not destroyed through this transition. So there is no reason why the Fermi surface volume should be different here and here, or right next to the critical point. Of course, in this spin density wave state, the Fermi surface will change due to the fact that we have antiferromagnetism. But this change will evolve continuously from this point on. I mean, the Fermi, there will be gapping, and small gaps will open in the Fermi surface just through the fact that antiferromagnetism doubles the unit cell volume, or halves the unit cell, doubles the unit cell volume, exactly. So there will be a continuous change within this phase, but right next to delta C, the Fermi surface volume is expected to be unchanged. This is very different from new scenarios where it is considered that the heavy quasi-particles might break down at the quantum critical point. So they are heavy quasi-particles. Here we have a large Fermi surface volume here, but here the local moments just order, and the heavy quasi-particles somehow fall apart. So in this case, of course, a huge change, or a sizable change between the Fermi surface volume here and here is expected, which could happen discontinuously, because suddenly the 4F moments do not contribute any longer to the Fermi surface, but they order magnetically. So the question is whether we have this scenario or this scenario describes better the physics of ytterbium, rhodium to silicon 2, and of course it would be interesting to know how other systems can be classified. So the
both are second order transition. Both.
Oh yes, 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 absolutely. That is a prerequisite for talking about quantum critical point at all. I mean, if this is a first order transition, then of course the Fermi surface volume can change in any case. But it has, I mean, this transition has to be of second order in order to talk of, to be able to talk of quantum criticality at all. So the theoretical predictions for the Hall coefficient follow directly from what I've said before. So you see the inverse of the Hall coefficient here, which is it's in some way related to the charge carrier concentration or to the volume of the Fermi surface. And you see that in this spin density wave scenario, you have, okay, some volume here, and then right next to the critical concentration, you still have the same volume, which will then evolve with the order parameter if you go deeper into the antiferromagnetic state. But there is no discontinuity. In these other scenarios, which I call as local here, but that's not accounting for all the different models which go in this direction, is that the family surface volume is large in the Landau family liquid, paramagnetic Landau family liquid, but small in the antiferromagnet, because there the local moments do not contribute.
What happens in the first scenario in case of nesting? The EF just becomes infinite?
What becomes infinite?
What happens in the first FDW scenario if there is a nesting?
Well, this will look like this in the nesting case as well. Just the change can be very, very sizable.
The EF just becomes infinite.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah.
I'm not sure. You could certainly imagine cases in which you would get a discontinuity. If I considered, you know, some kind of model of perfect nesting, then the antiferromagnetic phase might be an insulator. Right?
Right.
An insulator, then it's not
but still the gap opens
up. But
still
it has to
evolve. So.
But if I'm really at zero temperature.
But doesn't it have to evolve with the order parameter? I mean, the order parameter will evolve continuously, isn't it?
You want to be a little careful with
that.
The discontinuity would have to do with a gap.
Yeah.
The Fermi surface would have to be perfectly flat. 100%.
Right, but he was asking about
You never get this in reality, that you get a perfectly flat case.
Right, but you can make it be very steep, certainly.
Okay.
I mean, there is also another complication, which is that the weak field limit, being tends to zero, is not going to be well defined in the limit that you open a gap. But you're going to have a sharp corner in your Fermi surface. And so the Zener-Jones expansion, which is the B tends to zero limit, is going to break down.
Okay.
But what you write is okay, but
it could be a small window.
Yeah.
Okay, you probably smeared out an experiment anyway. I don't know. Okay, now let me show you the results of the Kelvin rolling to silicon 2. It has a tetragonal structure. We measured the Hall effect on very nice single crystals, which have residual resistivities of the order of 1 microohm centimeter, so we believe that this order is not so important in these samples. The contour temperature is roughly 25 Kelvin, and we have an exceedingly small nail temperature of only 70 millikelvin. And correspondingly, the ordered moment is also extremely small. It's only 2 times 10 to the minus 3 mu Bohr Bohr magnetron per ytterbium as estimated from USR measurements. Then the critical field for the suppression of the antiferromagnetic order is it's not isotropic. So there's a higher field if you apply the field along the hard C direction. You need 0.7 tesla to suppress antiferromagnetism. And if you apply it in the soft tetragonal plane here, then you need only 60 millitesla to suppress the antiferromagnetism. And this is shown also in this phase diagram here, which was established from resistivity measurements made by Philipp Gegenwart and his PhD student. So you see that the nail temperature, as you increase the magnetic field, is reduced and suppressed down to zero. This is the plot for the field applied along the C direction. And you can also put the data points for the field applied perpendicular to that by just scaling the field by a factor of 11. So then the two curves fall on top of each other. So the nail temperature is suppressed. We have the antiferromagnetic order here. And then below this line, Landau family liquid behavior, that is T-square resistivity is observed here.
May I ask two questions, one trivial and one sort of obnoxious. First, this factor of 11, is that just the G factor anisotropy in this? I mean, is it understood or is it accepted?
No, I think it's, I'm not sure. Let me see.
The G factor anisotropy is enormous.
Yeah.
I think it's not, it doesn't cover
0.17 compared to
3.86 something like that. Well, the lattice coefficient is extremely different for the two field directions. Yeah. One is very small and one is...
That's almost the same thing as the G factor anisotropy. Okay, but so at least some of this difference is just how strongly the magnetic field that you apply talks to the system.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, now, what's known about sample quality? In particular, I was recently reading these papers from Paul Canfield on a different material, this ytterbium nickel carbon thing, and they claim that you got quite different results according to whether you annealed the samples for 150 hours or not. So, they said that it was quite sensitive to what they claim were basically microstructural domain walls.
Well, I mean, I think there has no real detailed study been done by of annealing and comparing samples. I think the argument which is usually being used is that the residual resistivity is really small, and that somehow is guaranteeing that the samples are not too bad. But I think there has no detailed study has been done.
Do you want people to believe that the magnetism is homogeneous?
Well, I think that's belief, but I mean, it's, we can really not prove it because we don't have any microscopic technique by which we can resolve the magnetic moment.
But well, there have been cases in which the muon people have argued that magnetism is inhomogeneous.
Yeah, but look, the moment is so small that they are just overly happy to see something at all, and I think they can really not say anything of that. Yeah.
On the high field side, though, do you see quantum oscillations in the resistivity?
It has not yet been found, no. Philip Ingwald is still working on that.
But someone has seen the Hoffman alpha. There's been a claim.
Someone has seen the Hoffman alpha? Who?
Fouquet's.
Fouquet? Well.
Someone in Cambridge.
Who knows? Yeah. On Fouquet samples?
Someone named Bristol.
Okay, it's anyway, it's not published yet, so I don't officially know anything about that. Okay, what I show you first is the Hall effect measurements when I come down this line, so in the limit of zero magnetic field. And I show you the whole temperature range, so from room temperature down to roughly 20 millikelvin. The reason I have to do that is I have to get rid of contributions to the Hall coefficient which do not say anything about the Fermi surface volume, and in heavy Fermi compounds that's usually the anomalous Hall effect which I have to extract, subtract from the data so the rest of the data can be analyzed in terms of Fermi surface volume, or at least a bit more reliably than if I don't do that. So this strong temperature dependence is well known from heavy Fermi compounds, and this high temperature feature here is entirely due to the anomalous Hall coefficient. And this is shown in this view graph here. So there's this, well, it's not really a model, it's just an experimental observation that many heavy Fermi compounds behave according to this law, that there is a temperature independent part, R0, and then a contribution which is proportional to the electrical resistivity times the magnetic susceptibility. And that our sample holds, this relation holds for our compound. So here we are where we plot the Hall coefficient as function of rho times T, where temperature is the internal parameter. And we see that the data between 7 Kelvin and room temperature fall on a straight line. That means it just follows this linear relationship. And we can extract the temperature independent contribution and the prefactor of the temperature dependent contribution. So you see that from 7 Kelvin on there is a deviation, but in the high temperature range, this relation is very well fulfilled. So all the temperature dependence from this high temperature part comes just from the anomalous Hall effect. And it is only the temperature independent part which we are interested in, which is related to the charge carrier concentration. But even in the temperature independent part, there can be an anomalous Hall effect contribution. That is the extrinsic anomalous Hall effect, which is due to scattering from residual defects. And we also have to estimate that one. So Hall coefficient in the limit T equal to zero is a temperature independent quantity, of course. It is composed of the normal Hall coefficient, which is related to charge carrier concentration, and this extrinsic contribution. And we can estimate the extrinsic contribution from the residual resistivity and from the magnetic susceptibility. And we see that it is very small. It is less than 4% of the total temperature independent contribution. And this is shown here on this view graph again. So this is the extrinsic contribution, and this is the total temperature-independent contribution here. So we see that, the zero is here. It's within the scattering of the data, I think it's negligible, these 4%. So what we see is that the R0, the temperature-independent contribution, is almost entirely due to the normal Hall coefficient in our compound. One other thing which we see is very astonishing for us. We see that the fit of the data was only done in this temperature range, from here to here. But we see that our data, in fact, fall on top of the extrapolation of our fit as we go to zero, to low temperature limit. And this was not at all expected, because it means that our sand surface volume is the same at high as it is at low temperatures, because this R0 results just from fitting the high temperature part. And you know that there's this compound is believed to be a heavy fermion compound, so you might expect that at high temperature the local moments do not contribute, but then at low temperatures they do. But that's not what we see here. We see that the still at low temperature the fermion surface volume is small in this language. Yeah.
Can you remind me what you said what the condo temperature was going to be?
25 Kelvin.
So that should appear even within the range of this
yes.
temperature fit.
But we don't see anything there, yeah. That was very surprising. We didn't understand at all in the beginning why this happens. Okay, this is sort of a side remark. I just want to make a comment about this region of temperature here. So in that region, what we observe is that the cotangent of the Hall angle follows a T-square behavior. So probably here is the temperature square. At least it seems to follow it quite nicely. If you blow it up a little bit, you show the deviation from this law, you see that at the lowest temperatures there is some sizable deviation. So I believe that this law, well, it holds well at high temperatures, but not if you go very close to the quantum critical point.
Can I just ask about, so on the previous one, there's a 100% change in RH between 1 Kelvin and 0. How much does the resistivity change over that temperature range?
Sorry, between?
1 Kelvin and 0. The value of RH changes by a factor of 2.
Yeah.
How much does the resistivity change?
Oh, well.
From 1 Kelvin to 0.
I don't have the data here. Well, it's linear in T.
With a residual.
With the residual, of course. Oh, I don't have it in mind.
Okay.
I could be of the same order, I think.
Yeah. Where are we in the phase diagram? Is B bigger or smaller than B?
B is 0. I mean, this is the limit of B equals 0. It's just this is the slope, initial slope of the measurements. Okay, maybe I think I will be very brief on this. It's just to remind you that the Hall the cotangent of the Hall angle, this T-square dependence has been observed in other heavy fermion or compounds or in high TC superconductor, and was somehow believed to be this non-fermi liquid signature of the Hall effect. I think it is true in the high temperature range, but I think it doesn't really hold strictly down to the very lowest, down to very close to the quantum critical point. Okay, now I show you measurements crossing the phase diagram like this. So we do the field tuning. We use the magnetic field to tune the system through this quantum critical point, or of course at finite temperature. I have to introduce here what we call the single and the cross-field experiments, because now we have the complication that the magnetic field is used to measure the Hall coefficient, and at the same time it's used to tune the system through the quantum critical point. So we have to pay attention here. The usual measurement is just done by applying a magnetic field perpendicular to the current, and perpendicular to both of it we measure the Hall response. So now if we measure as a function of this field, which is the only field in this experiment, we measure the Hall resistivity as a function of this field, and we have to extract from this curve many data points, because we want to see the evolution of the Hall coefficient as a function of B. So what we have to do here is look at the slope, at the local slope. Take it here, which is the initial Hall coefficient, and then take it as a function of B, and try to see whether this is related to the linear response Hall coefficient. And it was found by our theoreticians that it is not directly the Hall coefficient, but there is a second contribution, which we call the Zeeman term, which could screw up the whole thing. I mean, which could dominate this term, and then it actually the slope would have nothing to do with the Hall coefficient. I will show later that
question about notations. What is R tilde, what is R here?
Okay, the RH with the tilde is just the slope of this curve. The local slope. You see this, I mean, it's the slope at each point. It's the derivative of this curve.
Okay.
And the RH is the normal linear response Hall coefficient. Okay, you see that the slope is not only the linear response Hall coefficient, but there is a second term which could come into play.
That's just because of Zeeman splitting, which means
yes.
you have two Fermi surfaces of different size in the simple picture, one for spin up and one for spin down.
Is it?
I don't know. Yeah.
It's just tuning the system.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
Well, I mean, you can
think of the orbital coupling that produces Lorentz force by B1, right?
That's the question.
Assuming that the system itself is not changing as B1 is changed. And that's
and
a putative.
The system changes as B1 is changed,
yes.
Because?
Well, presumably some kind of Zeeman dipolar coupling. So it could be Zeeman coupling, could be, but we don't really know how this system, what's the coupling term in the Hamiltonian that's actually tuning the system? It's just a control parameter as far as the.
Something which suggests that the system might change under a
tuning. The bottom line is just that the shape of the Fermi surface changes and the object which is measured comes from the shape of the Fermi surface, or is there something else? That's what I'm trying to understand. Mm-hmm.
It's anti-ferromagnetism.
Being rid of the magnetism,
just think of it as a tuning parameter.
Yes or no?
He's not happy.
No, but that's all right.
Since there are not too many of us here, let's discuss this in some more detail.
Just the way I thought about it, right? All of these whole responses are determined essentially by the curvature of the Fermi surface and the scattering mechanism.
Yeah.
So I can imagine that as you apply a magnetic field, you change the curvature of the Fermi surface. For the most obvious reason that you just put a Zeeman splitting, so the Fermi surface for spin up is different from spin down, and both of them are different from zero D.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to know, is that the basic effect, or is there something else? And it's all very well to say there's an effect, I just want to know what is actually the effect.
Well, there's a weak field regime, okay? This is supposedly there's a weak field
regime. Right. And therefore?
Well, anything that's beyond just the orbital Lorentz force linear response is lumped in the Zeeman.
Okay, so at the moment this is just
we don't know what it is, actually, yes. All the rest.
Okay. All right.
Well, we would show that it's small, but.
Okay.
Okay, then we have.
In the very neat field limit, do you get. What direction had you applied the field, and does it matter?
Well, we could apply it all the time only in the hard direction because the samples are platelets which are oriented perpendicular to that direction. So always in the hard direction.
How low in temperature is this?
Well, this is just a sketch. I will show you then data below and above the nail temperature of 70 millikelvin. Then in the second experiment, we apply two fields, and that is in order to separate the effect of tuning and measuring the Hall coefficient. So we have the field which creates the Hall response, B1, which will be a very small field in this case. So we use only the linear response regime for this experiment, and then we have a field perpendicular to that, which we call B2, which will then just tune the system to the quantum critical point. So what we measure is curves like this, Hall resistivity versus field B1. Of these, we extract only the initial slope, and then we apply different fields B2. And we look at how the Hall coefficient, the linear response Hall coefficient in that case, evolves as a function of B2. So then we don't have the complication that there a second term comes in from using the same field for tuning and measuring the Hall coefficient. So I start with the first experiment. Here you see the Hall coefficient. In fact, we had to subtract a small anomalous contribution. Again, we have to pay attention that if we apply a magnetic field, we can, again, have some anomalous contributions. But we know how the magnetic susceptibility behaves as a function of the field. It's just very small and linear, and we could make a correction. So this is, again, very important, because even if you're convinced that at zero field, at the lowest temperature, you have no anomalous contribution, as a function of field, there might still come up an anomalous contribution. And in our case, it was very small, and we could correct for it. So you see the Hall resistivity corrected for this term as a function of field. And what is observed is that we have a region where you have linear behavior, linear and field behavior, and a second region where you again have linear and field behavior. So sort of two linear regimes with different slope. And at the lowest temperature, the crossover between these two regimes is relatively sharp. It is 29 millikelvin, and at the highest temperatures, it's just bronze. So we are now interested in the local slope of this, which is shown here again, or we can, of course, make a derivative of our curves. That is this curve here, which is already the R tilde. The derivative of the blue curve is this line here. You see again that there's one level here, a crossover, and a second level to a different value. So now we want to extract some parameters from this, and therefore we just use a fit function, which means nothing, but it's just in order to extract useful parameters. Now this is the function which we use for the derivative of the data. There's the high field level, the low field level, the crossover position, and as a derivative of this, we can extract the full width of half maximum, which tells us something about how sharp this transition is. And we fit this function to the data, and these are the crossover position, which are these points here, and this is the width of the crossover as a function of temperature. So what you see first of all is that the position of the crossover goes directly to the quantum critical point. So this shows that we have a direct relation between this crossover and Hall coefficient and the quantum critical point. What is very important to state is also that it does not follow the nail temperature here. So the sharpest crossover is really at this line and not at this line, which would we expect it if we had a spin density wave picture, because then the change of Fermi surface volume would be directly related to the onset of antiferromagnetism, and we should observe our change here, which is definitely not the case. Then the full width of maximum is plotted here on a log-log scale, and we can fit it with a simple pure power law. It's T to the 0.5. And this means, of course, if we extrapolate the data to zero temperature, which is a far away, infinity, in fact, that the transition would be infinitely sharp. This means that in the zero temperature limit, of course, extracted from measurements at finite temperature, we would expect that the Fermi surface volume jumps. Because this transition between the high value of the Hall coefficient and the low value of the Hall coefficient would then occur as a step. So now I show the cross-field experiments. Again, we have this Hall resistivity versus field curves, which I've shown you on the sketch before, and we just take the initial slope of these measurements. And now we plot this initial slope as a function of the magnetic field B2. So we made the measurement at different fields B2, let's plot it here, and we just take the initial slope. And these are the results. So you see again, the blue curve was taken at the lowest temperatures, that it is the sharpest transition, and the red one was taken at the highest temperature, it's relatively broad. The temperature window which we could access is relatively small because we had to use the second coil, which was a handmade small coil, and we couldn't reach a very wide temperature window with this setup. So we have only measurements between 45 and 93 millikelvin. But I think that the evolution is already observed quite clearly, that the curves sharpen up as the temperature is reduced. We have already scaled it to the crossover field here, that's why you have the same crossing point for all curves. But of course we extracted this parameter, the crossover field, which will be plotted in the next view graph. So you see here the crossover position for these four points falls nicely on top of the points determined for the single field experiment. So the crossover happens in both experiments at the same position. Let me just go back here once. I want to say something about the absolute values. So here you see that the change is roughly from 1.2 to 0.8. That means we have a relative change of the Hall coefficient. And this is really the initial Hall coefficient, the linear response Hall coefficient, of 35%. If you want to explain this within the spin density wave scenario, we have to see how big of a change you have in the order parameter. And the magnetic moment, as I said already, as deep in the antiferromagnetic side as we can measure, which is at zero field, it's only 2 millimuebor per ytterbium. And that means if you put the two into perspective, it's really a huge effect. You have a really sizable change of the Hall coefficient, and the magnetic moment changes only by such a small value. So this is not easily explained within a spin density wave scenario.
But didn't I already know that just from the measurements at zero field, where essentially nothing happened to the Hall coefficient
through
GNL?
Yes, you could argue, yes. But, well, it's better to double check.
Can I also conclude from this picture that if I eliminate antiferromagnetite from the phase diagram, nothing will happen? Everything else will stay.
Oh, how can you know?
Well, you see lines that are totally unrelated with nail temperature.
No, it's not true. I mean, the point here is exactly where nail temperature vanishes.
If I go from high temperature
here,
down,
nothing happens.
No, I go along the red.
Wait a second. You do a field sweep.
Now the these points are, I mean, all the points are taken from such sweep.
No, but I'm saying you're doing a field sweep, and the nail temperature is almost horizontally flat. I mean, it's a really bad geometry to see if anything's going on.
Well, I mean, we crossed also well below the nail temperature here, or in this case, in the single field.
I mean, it's within the error bars of your data, you're almost at the nail temperature.
If you're close to the nail temperature, the error bar, of course, is relatively big, but for this case, I mean, I think you cross it almost perpendicularly. And
Wait,
Andre's point is somewhat different. Just the point is, if I just look at much higher temperatures, 0.2 and 0.3, I already see precursors of this transition.
Of the same effect, exactly the same effect.
Right.
And as such, I think it play no role in the story at all.
So
that's why the hypothesis is that the antiferromagnetism is some kind of parasitic effect. And
you could argue,
phase
yes.
transition with some hidden order parameter.
But still, it's not a coincidence that where the nail temperature vanishes, this effect happens, I think.
I would put it differently.
Yeah?
When this temperature vanishes, somehow antiferromagnetism appears.
Yeah, you can put it this way. Well, if you like.
Is there any evidence in specific heat that something happens at this crossover temperature?
Well, actually, from specific heat, we would draw a line rather somewhere in between this crossover temperature and the temperature below which we see the Landau-Fermi liquid behavior.
So the T-star
is not really
the T-square behavior, the resistivity.
Resistivity. And from the specific heat, you would draw some line in between. But of course, it's also a question of how you define really the crossover position. So definitely, this is not the same line as this one. I think that's obvious. The specific heat seems to be somewhere in between.
May I ask, do you have a plot of, let's say, the temperature coefficient of resistivity, if I just make a field sweep at some temperature, like 150 millikelvin, right? Then I could define, a d rho by dt or d log rho by to get an exponent.
Well, I mean, this was done in this in the Nature paper by Jerome Custis. They don't really plot the coefficient, but they have this color plot, where blue was coefficient 2 and red was coefficient 1, and there's, of course, it's not so,
I guess my question.
But it's in all this area where you have 1, and it's really here and here where you have 2.
Right, and how about up? I mean, the question is, does the area of coefficient approximately 1 extend up?
Oh, yeah, it extends up to very high temperatures.
Good, so that's sort of, and your T Hall line is roughly consistent with their line of exponent 1?
Yeah, with the, where it's most red, that's in this area. But it extends really up to, almost 10 Kelvin, the linear behavior. It's a huge area.
The T-star,
no, that's where, I thought that was where T-squared was.
This
one.
So everywhere
above this T1. Okay. Well, of course, there's a crossover, between T2 and T1.
Okay.
Okay, also in this plot here, of course, within the error bar, obviously, the two data sets correspond very well to each other. And it's just from this good agreement of the characteristic parameters that we say that both experiments probe the same thing. And that's our argument to say that this, what we call Zeeman or additional contribution to the linear response Hall coefficient is not important in this system. So that's sort of a check whether this term is important or not. And we come to the conclusion that it's not, and that even the single field experiment already measures the linear response Hall coefficient.
Here, excuse me, Matt, I'll do the usual theorist thing of asking for the impossible, or at least the very inconvenient. So let me take a totally skeptical view of your inset of the full width half maximum.
Yes.
Okay. So it appears to me that your lowest data point in temperature here, right, corresponds to a full width half max of about 2.5.
Yes.
Right, because it's still
0.25.
It's 0.1, right?
0.25.
Yes,
exactly.
Tesla. So now I go back to your phase diagram. Right? Now I sit myself at the critical point. Now I go backwards 0.25 Tesla into the ordered phase.
Okay, that's 2. And only half of that, 0.2, so half of that, because that's the full wind tunnel maximum, we have to go back 1 to 5, 0.125.
Right, so it's a little beyond that, that first tick mark, right?
Yes, like here.
So if
it's roughly this, yeah, right, a bit
so
more.
So if I go up, I'm still basically in the region where T-nail has its zero field value.
T-nail has...
Right, if I just go vertically up from
yes,
that point...
Yes, to here, somewhere?
Yeah, or even a little to the left, but that's my question is, is your lowest point, or can you get a data point where you really are in the critical regime in the sense that T-nail is substantially suppressed from its zero field value, right? In other words, do these data really prove that the half-width is less than the region where T-nail is going from its zero field value down to zero? You see what I'm asking?
I know, yes. Well, I think it's difficult to say because the nail temperature is already so small.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, our lowest measurement point is, it was 16 millikelvin and it's 70. So you can, of course, I mean,
yeah,
only go not even a factor of 10 down below the nail temperature with the lowest measurement. Of course, that's a relatively narrow window.
And what's the key point of the question? The
question is, suppose that the fall coefficient is really changing smoothly through the phase transition. The cynical point of view would be that even at the lowest temperature, the full width path max basically overlaps the region where you see significant variation in T-nail. So you're somehow basically always sampling either the ordered phase or the other phase.
Right, but somehow this still implies that the changes are associated with the development of antifermity.
Well, or whatever is the hidden order.
But it happens here as well.
Are you looking at discontinuity, or are you looking at a smooth behavior just with a rather narrow critical regime? And the implication of the scaling block is that, of the full one path max, is that you're really looking at a discontinuity, because if you really extrapolated this to zero, you know, the width would become infinitesimal.
Of course,
and you know, one would be happier if you had a point where the full width path max was really, you know, so narrow that your T-nail was all very strongly suppressed.
In some sense, if you focus on last point, one point on this entire set of measurements, it's very hard to make a reference statement. One really has to look at the evolution.
Right. It's basically, but the point, the question is whether the scaling behavior is just cut off by the width of the transition, which you haven't sampled yet. Right.
I think you can experimentally not really do it, though. I mean, that's obvious. I mean, this could separate somewhere here. We cannot tell. I mean, we never will be able to tell anyway. I mean, I think we made the measurement at 0.1 millikelvin or something. Okay, so this is just showing the whole data set again for the initial whole response. And these are the points where we have field-tuned system to the Landau-Fermi liquid phase. And you see that there's a sizable difference between the initial Hall response in the zero field phase, where the system is antiferromagnetic, and in the field-tuned paramagnetic state. So while at B equals zero in the initial Hall response measurement, we have the same Hall coefficient or the same Fermi surface volume at high and at low temperatures, we have a distinctly different one if we are in the field-tuned paramagnetic state. What we believe this one, this is due to here is that close to the in an area around the critical point, we have fluctuations of the Fermi surface volume because it is up at roughly 10 Kelvin where non-Fermi liquid behavior starts to be observed, and that is exactly the temperature where we see this additional contribution. And all this we attribute to, we take it as a fingerprint in the Hall coefficient for non-Fermi liquid behavior. It's this additional contribution, and then, which vanishes if we really go into the antiferromagnetic state where we don't have a non-Fermi liquid behavior any longer. And why we observe it over such a large temperature range is due to the fact that this transition is really relatively broad. So you can see that this is the temperature axis, this is the nail temperature, and if we measure the system along this line here, due to the fact that this crossover broadens so much, we see already effects of the fluctuating or of the change of the family surface volume, even if we measure down in this range here. So that's why we believe all these additional feature in the Hall coefficient is due to the change of the family surface volume, which expands to finer temperatures. So at the our extrapolation to the t equals zero plane is, of course, then that this crossover becomes infinitely sharp by extrapolation from finer temperature data, and that there we have the discontinuous transition between small and large family surface volume. So let me just conclude about this and then show you some other experiments available in the literature. So we have proven, I think, that the Hall coefficient for ethereum rhodium to silicon 2 at the lowest temperatures is a good tool to study possible family surface volume changes, because we have really no anomalous contributions, or in the case of finite fields, we can subtract them, we can get rid of them. And that is by far not the case in all heavy family compounds. It's a very difficult task to separate this in general. Then we have shown that the Hall coefficient related to charge carrier concentration, so the normal Hall coefficient, is the same at high and at the lowest temperatures in ethereum rhodium to silicon 2, which says that it is, in principle, not a heavy fermion compound, or it doesn't, it's not a heavy fermion compound with large Fermi surface in the T equals zero state, which was very surprising for us at first. And I remember very hard discussions with Hilbert von Löweneisen, who said, this is not possible. You have to see the big Fermi surface in the state at T equals zero, because you have a heavy fermion compound, you have a huge gamma term of this compound. So this is still a question of how to understand this, really, because we see all typical heavy fermion features for this compound, even in the state at T equals zero. But still, we claim that the Fermi surface is normal, it's not a large one. Then from our cross-field and single-coil experiments, we extrapolate from the finer temperature measurements that in the limit of T equals zero, we would have a jump of the normal Hall coefficient at the quantum critical point, and this would be in contradiction with the spin density wave scenario. Okay, now let me show just some other results of other groups. Of course, it's the most obvious thing to do is to study Fermi surface volume changes. We would look at the de Haast von Alphen experiments. And this has been done for a serum rhodium to silicon 2, where you see in this plot the sublattice moment, which here the dark spots, goes down to zero from a quite sizable value of 1.2. The nail temperature, in fact there are two transitions, but let's look just at this one transition here, 30 Kelvin here, and then it's suppressed, and the lowest point they could detect is 10 Kelvin, so it's still quite far from the transition. And this is the de Haast von Alphen plot, and of course you see close to this transition here, so it's tuned as a function of pressure in this compound, you see a sizable change of some of the branches at least. And of course one could argue, look, this is a discontinuous change of the Fermi surface. But you have to be a bit careful in interpreting it so straightforwardly. One thing is that the transition is extremely sharp, and it is argued that it's possibly of first order in this compound. That's one thing why this maybe discontinuous change does not have to mean that the spin density wave scenario doesn't apply for this compound, because it could be a first order transition.
It's more than that. I mean, we do half an alpha, and by definition, is done at high fields.
Yeah, that's the second point, what I wanted to say. Of course, if you're extremely close to a critical point, then a field of 10 or 15 Tesla, I mean, what does it do to the system? In our case, it would put us completely away from the critical point. So in a pressure-tuned experiment, using very high magnetic fields is a very complicated thing, and I think you cannot really look close to the quantum critical point in this case, because you drive the system away with magnetic fields. What could be done, and I think that would be a very interesting possibility, to use a system where a high field is needed to make it drive the quantum critical. And there's this system, unfortunately I don't have the compound's name in mind, but it has recently been published in a FISREF letter, field tuning with the Haast von Alphen, where the critical field was 40 Tesla or something, but they couldn't go beyond.
Ceremonium.
Yes, exactly. Okay, exactly. So in this case, I think that would be very interesting to observe the evolution from here to here. But actually, the field they had at their disposal was just the critical field, or so they couldn't really drive the system through. But so in that case,
why don't you just do ceremonium through the silicon too? You know the Fermi surface changes discontinuously when you go through the critical field. Is it 8 tesla? So you can do all measurements on that.
Yeah, but isn't that first order as well?
No, it's not first order.
I think it's a metamagnetic transition.
Yeah, it's a metamagnetic transition, but
if the differential Hall effect there also means something. Yeah. Right?
Yeah. If the Fermi surface is changing discontinuously, then you should see it in the first Hall measurement.
Yeah, well, they couldn't analyze the data of the Hall coefficient. I think it was too complicated.
It's a related question, maybe, you know, Aaron. I mean, this strontium 3 would be leading to 7, right? There it's why we believe that there is a transition of somewhat complicated structure where you precisely change the Fermi surface volume essentially by running bands into the zone boundary. So the Fermi surface topology changes through a well-defined field-driven transition. Have these kind of experiments been done?
Yep.
And what do you see?
So you've got a number of regions, and you can see, so they've done it in Chimnikov-Tahalis rather than UHVA.
Yeah.
So you can see frequency changes going through the metamagnetic transition. They can even now, there's a little window of rather strange behavior near the crack down point itself. They've now even got some quantum oscillations in that region, which show completely different frequencies. The orbits that they can track, essentially the difference in areas corresponds to the magnetization changes that you would expect. So it looks like you can see an itinerant picture of Fermi surfaces expanding and contracting according to
right.
spin.
And the Hall effect does.
And the Hall effect shows a little glitch as you go through the endpoint. So if you do a field sweep measuring RH, it's linear in field, then shows a little glitch and stays, well, we were discussing this yesterday, that I'm not sure whether the slope changes, I don't think the slope changes very much if it changes at all on the other side of the metamagnetic transition. You usually spin up and spin down Fermi surfaces as you split them. The combination of those two things gives the Hall number, and so you don't normally actually see a very large
change. Until you run one over the zone boundary.
Until you hit the zone boundary.
Okay, so the phenomenology of that material, therefore, looks somewhat different than what we heard about this, and in particular this.
And it goes as an evolves with the nail temperature?
Well, that's the nail temperature.
Okay. Okay, then I show these results on the vanadium doped chromium system, where it has been shown very nicely that this transition of the inverse Hall coefficient here is continuous. So that is an experiment where pressure experiments and doping experiments have been combined. And you see this continuous evolution of the Hall coefficient as you go into the antiferromagnetic state. And it has been shown in addition that this happens at the position where you have the nail temperature. So it's not happening in such an area where we see all crossover, but it really goes with the nail temperature as is expected in the spin density wave scenario. Then I have this picture on a high TC superconductor where Hall resistivity was measured in very high fields. And from the slope, the high field slope, the Hall coefficient was extracted because, of course, here it's superconducting. You cannot measure the Hall coefficient in the low field area. But they claim that the high field Hall coefficient still is the linear response Hall coefficient. And they show this linear response Hall coefficient as a function of doping. And in fact, there is some sort of something strange happening close to optimum doping. And it was speculated that this is related to some quantum critical behavior. And then the last thing I'm going to show is this recent measurements on ytterbium silver germanium, where you have again the Hall coefficient as a function of field. And in this compound, it looks a bit more complicated, so you have a strong field dependence. Unfortunately, I don't know what the magnetization does in this in the same field and temperature range. And what they did is they extract the position of the maximum and draw it in the phase diagram. And they think that this shows a crossover or a change of Fermi surface happening at this position. However, if I look at at one curve here and I draw a plot slope. So in our case, what we did from this corresponds to the single field experiment in our case. The Hall coefficient as a function of fields, we have to take the slope of these. And we see that the low field slope is somehow the same as the high field slope. And there's only some additional contribution close to the possible quantum critical point. And in the way we interpreted it, it would mean that the Fermi surface volume stays the same in this region, so in the magnetically ordered state, and in this region here. So I would be very glad to discuss with these people what they think about it. I think that's it. Thank you for your attention.
So do you have any pictures of resistivity sweeps as a function of field at base temperature? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering is if there are any sort of glitches.
No, I don't think I have any. Oh, yes, no. But this is a plot. Well, that is a more complicated plot. I did some. Well, I mean, it's somehow it's somehow what the resistivity does is function of field.
Yes.
But it's plotted in this way because we wanted to see that whether the resistivity does something at the crossover position, and we came to the conclusion that nothing really happens to the resistivity. There's only this feature which is related to the antiferromagnetic ordering, and you can see that this maximum goes down in field as you increase the temperature, so it really follows the nail temperature, this feature here. But at our crossover position for the Hall coefficient, there happens essentially nothing.
So this is very bizarre, right? Because, I mean, look, the same thing that would cause a jump in RH should also cause a jump in the residual resistance.
No, in single electron, sure.
Yeah, and it should be square. So the effect should be even more dramatic in resistivity than in the Hall number,
right,
if you think about it, as a Fermi surface change.
Yeah, but on the other hand, in a Hall coefficient, if you stick with the Fermi liquid, which is only on the two sides, it will be okay, all the renormalization factors pretty much cancel out, while in sigma x axis itself, it does not. It's complicated.
Yeah, but it would be very surprising if the complication was such as to make no net effect.
I agree with you. I'm just saying you cannot expect a square relationship when interactions.
But still, do you expect that rho will jump at the point when the Fermi surface area jump?
Expect to see something.
Yeah. Well, see something means jump, or yeah.
Mm-hmm. May I ask, just because I'm not so familiar with this compound, how does the heavy fermion behavior evolve?
I mean, you know, if I increase field, what happens to C over T, for example?
Okay, there are plots of the gamma coefficient, and we see that on both sides of the critical field, the gamma coefficient is increasing very much. So it's, I mean, you can fit something which says that it's diverging on both sides.
You mean as I approach this?
As you approach the critical field from both sides. So, I mean, right. Somewhere the critical field here, so the gamma goes up here. And it goes like this, and it seems to separate at a higher value in the antiferromagnet than here. But of course, this region is very narrow, and it's not so.
But does it continue to evolve if I go, you know, 5 Tesla or something? Does the gamma?
It goes down, yes. Yeah.
It does. But it's still, you know, like within a factor of 2 of the zero field value or something.
No.
It get much smaller.
No, it's smaller.
Okay. So rapidly, this Fermi liquid phase is becoming unheavy somehow.
Well, I mean, do you have the values in mind? You know, how much it decreases? Maybe, yes.
I thought there was a region in this the phase diagram where the susceptibility was basically taking off like 1 over T.
Yeah, you can make fits in some temperature ranges of Curie bias with very small rise temperatures.
So the reason I'm asking this is that so your subtraction from this anomalous effect probably is strongly dependent on B and T, right? Because of all these weirdities in the how the susceptibility changes.
Yeah, sure. Of course, we take the magnetization versus field curves and take exactly at the same temperature and field we are measuring and subtract this. Well, actually, in the hard direction, the magnetization is very—it's easy. It's just very small and linear. You don't see any effect of this quantum critical point in the magnetization if you apply the field in the hard direction.
Yeah. Can I go back for a second to this plot? Suppose you go to highest temperature with your reactor. There is some finite width of fields when Hall coefficient changes.
Yes.
What is this width of the field?
Okay. 500 millikelvin.
Yeah.
So a bit more than 1 Tesla.
1 Tesla, so
want
if you
to go
back to, yeah. Yeah.
For a full width half maximum 1 Tesla, so half a Tesla, this would be.
So it's still pretty narrow in this range.
Here and here.
Mm-hmm. And nothing happens in the boundaries.
Well, of course, you can argue that there might be a tiny change and it's smeared out, but it should be more obvious here then, because here the width is much smaller already, and I think you really don't see anything. It's just this nail temperature feature which.
So it looks from this curve as if really what the resistivity is seeing is actually the nail temperature,
yes.
Right?
Exactly. That's how it's extracted, the nail temperature. From the Hall coefficient, you could never extract the nail temperature because you don't see it.
So the resistivity only sees the nail temperature, but the Hall number sees
nothing but
spray. Which is also like what happens in zero field. If you look at temperature dependence of resistivity, it's that linear when the Hall coefficient is in this bump. And
yeah, it's this bump.
Yeah.
But supposedly, I mean, you said this bump was due to Fermi surface fluctuation effects, but in the IPC case, the interpretation is that you have a T-squared scattering rate from the Hall resistance and a linear T-scattering rate in the longitudinal resistance, and this is what causes this bump effect, right?
You mean the cotangent of the Hall line?
Yeah,
stuff? Yeah, but that holds only in this temperature. I mean, it doesn't hold down to low temperatures in our case.
I mean, in the standard high TC explanation, it's not a Fermi surface volume effect, but it's a fact that the inelastic scattering rate is different in the Hall angle.
But I mean, so in our case, this cotangent Hall angle thing holds only from here to here. So we would expect that this continues.
Oh, I see. So you're saying below 1 Kelvin, this drop off.
It deviates. Strongly, I'm.
Yeah, just wondering why is it? Why is this Fermi surface fluctuations? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is why is the deviation only in one direction? Naively, if I had an average position of the Fermi surface and it would fluctuate to be smaller and it would fluctuate to be bigger. So therefore, the average would probably still be on your.
Well, level. I don't know whether you should say fluctuations. Well, I mean. I mean, the only thing what I see is that something happens at the same temperature. We have no non-Fermi liquid. What is really this is due to, and why this such a deviation? I have really no idea.
And does anybody know? Is there a system in which you see just as the trivial reconnection of the Fermi surface? And as you put on a field, right? You let's say expand the spin on Fermi surface, and at some point it hits the zone boundary and reconnects in some stupid way, right? So that must have an effect on the Hall resistance, right? Yeah. Are there systems where that effect has been documented and we know what it does?
Theoretically, I mean, it's a Lipschitz transition.
I
don't know.
What's the empirical answer in such a system?
No, I mean, in response to that, we actually recently looked at what would happen to the Hall effect across the Lipschitz transition. And the answer is that in the genetic cases, the Hall coefficient itself is continuous. Mm-hmm. But the slope of it, which could be manifesting in other transport quantities, can diverge.
Mm-hmm. And I think the 11 Tesla transition in strontium ruthenium is probably that sort of. You've expanded one of the majority of Fermi surfaces enough to hit the zone.
Right, and the phenomena which are observed in that transition are what?
Well, I can't remember what happens in RH 11 Teslas. I don't think very much happens.
Any more questions? If not, thank you very much.